Welcome back to the show. We're all about taking complex legal stuff and, well, making it make sense.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it.
And today, we are diving deep into Chapman v. California.
Okay.
It's a case that is still cited all the time.
Mm-hmm.
When courts have to figure out how to handle, you know, those moments where someone's constitutional rights get messed with during a trial.
Yeah, it's a landmark case for sure. I mean, it really forces us to think about this question. What happens when there's a mistake in a trial, but you're fairly certain that the person is guilty?
Right.
Yeah. Do you just kind of like overlook it?
Yeah.
Or are some rights just so important that any violation like automatically throws out the conviction?
Yeah, it's like a classic devil's advocate situation. Like, how do you balance protecting individual rights with, you know, making sure the legal system actually works and can put away criminals?
It's a tough one. Yeah. And Chapman v. California really takes us right into that dilemma. It all starts with this really brutal crime in California, a robbery, kidnapping, A&D murder, all of a bartender.
Oh, wow. Okay, so serious crime. So what's the constitutional issue here?
So two guys, Chapman and Teal, are convicted, right?
Okay.
But during the trial, the prosecution, they kept pointing out that Chapman and Teal chose not to testify.
Oh, interesting.
And they basically used that silence, that choice, to not take the stand, to try and make the jury think they were guilty.
Mm.
And, you know, the thing is, back then, this was completely legal under California law.
Wait, hold on. So you could be sitting in court, you know you've got that right to remain silent, but the prosecutor can still, like, twist that against you?
Yeah, pretty much.
That seems kind of, I don't know, counterintuitive to the whole right to remain silent concept.
You're totally right, it does. And to make it even more complicated, there's this other case going on at the Supreme Court at the same time, Griffin v. California. And that case was specifically about whether using a defendant's silence against them violated the Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination.
So you've got two cases kind of overlapping, one potentially influencing the other.
Yeah, the timing was crucial.
That's messy.
Well, Griffin v. California is actually decided while Chapman and Teal are appealing their convictions.
Oh, wow.
And guess what? The Supreme Court in Griffin ruled that, yep, it is a violation of the Fifth Amendment to comment on a defendant's silence.
That completely changes the game for Chapman and Teal, right?
It sure does. So they appeal their convictions, bring up this whole Griffin thing, and the California Supreme Court's like, okay, yeah, there was a violation. We see that now.
Yeah.
But they didn't overturn the convictions.
Really? Why not?
They said it was a harmless error.
A harmless error?
Yeah, basically because there was already so much evidence against those guys, they're saying, you know, the outcome would have been the same anyway.
So they're saying, we made a mistake, but they were guilty anyway, so no big deal. That just seems kind of dangerous, doesn't it?
Well, that's what the U.S. Supreme Court had to decide.
Okay.
Can you really just call a constitutional violation harmless, even if you're pretty sure the person's guilty?
So it's not just about Chapman and Teal at this point.
Not anymore. It's about how the entire system handles these kinds of errors.
The big picture stuff, yeah.
And this is where this idea of harmless error becomes really important.
Okay.
Because courts need some way to deal with those mistakes that happen during trials, right?
Yeah, I get that.
If every single error meant an automatic do-over, the system would just be completely bogged down.
Yeah, it would be chaos.
Total chaos.
Right.
But then, you know, on the other hand, if courts just ignore all these errors and say harmless all the time, well, that doesn't really protect people's rights, does it?
No, it doesn't. So how did the Supreme Court handle this?
So remember, the California Supreme Court decided to go with that harmless error argument. Well, the U.S. Supreme Court, they weren't so convinced.
Right. Let's hear it. What did they decide?
They actually overturned the California Supreme Court's decision.
Wow. Okay.
They said that, you know, when it comes to violating federal constitutional rights, federal law has to be the standard for harmless error, not whatever a state decides.
So California couldn't just use its own, like, more lenient rule.
Nope. The Supreme Court laid down the law for everyone. And this is where it gets really interesting.
Okay. I'm listening.
They said, okay, here's the new test. For a constitutional error to be considered harmless, the prosecution now has to prove, beyond a reasonable doubt, that that error didn't affect the guilty verdict.
Wow. Beyond a reasonable doubt. That's a really high bar to clear. That's the same standard used to prove guilt in the first place?
It is. They're basically saying, you messed up, now you have to prove it really didn't matter. And remember, in Chapman and Teal's case, the prosecution spent a lot of time talking about how they didn't testify.
Right.
Like, they brought it up over and over again, more than 15 times.
So given all that, harmless error seems like a tough sell.
Exactly. The Supreme Court basically said, all those comments about them not testifying, yeah, we can't be sure that didn't sway the jury.
Okay, so it sounds like this case did a lot more than just decide the fate of these two guys in California.
Right. Chapin didn't just overturn a conviction. It created a whole new standard for how courts deal with constitutional errors. And that harmless beyond a reasonable doubt test, it's still a cornerstone of criminal procedure even today.
That's incredible how one case can have such a ripple effect.
It really is. But remember, like with any big Supreme Court decision, there were a lot of opinions on how to handle this whole harmless error issue. Not everyone agreed.
Oh, for sure. So we have the majority opinion that sets up this new standard. But what about the justices who disagreed? What were their concerns?
Well, you have Justice Stewart, who actually agreed with the outcome that the convictions should be overturned. But he wanted to go even further. He was like, anytime a prosecutor comments on a defendant's silence, that should just automatically mean the conviction gets tossed out. No exceptions.
Oh, wow. So he's saying some rights are just so important that you don't even try to balance them against efficiency. Like, it doesn't matter how guilty you think someone is, you can't compromise those fundamental rights.
You got it. And then you have Justice Harlan, who went in a completely different direction.
Oh, how so?
Well, he thought states should have more freedom to figure out their own rules about harmless error. He was worried about federal courts stepping on states' toes.
So he's focused on states' rights, kind of like a balance of power argument.
Exactly. He believed that state courts could handle these issues fairly without the feds getting involved.
Wow, so even within the court, there were these drastically different opinions.
Absolutely. And that shows just how complicated and controversial this whole idea of harmless error is.
It's like we said before, it's a balancing act.
Yeah, it's a tough one. How do you uphold constitutional rights without letting the system grind to a halt?
Lots to think about, but I think it's time to recharge for a bit.
Right. Let's take a break.
We'll be back soon to explore how Chapman has actually played out in real-world cases.
We'll see how this harmless error standard works in action.
Okay, so we're back and ready to dive into how Chapman actually plays out in real-world cases.
Yeah, you know, it's one thing to talk about the legal theory behind this harmless beyond a reasonable doubt standard, but I think it really comes to life when you see how it's been applied in different situations.
Give me some examples, like where has Chapman had the biggest impact?
Well, one area is definitely in cases where evidence is admitted improperly. Like, let's say a confession is obtained illegally.
Ooh, yeah, like those situations where the police maybe, I don't know, pressured someone into confessing or something.
Yeah.
Those cases always make the news.
Exactly. So before Chapman, a court might have just looked at the confession and said, well, it seems pretty clear the guy's guilty, so let's just move on. But now, thanks to Chapman, they can't do that.
They have to really scrutinize that error.
Right.
Right. They have to look at the confession and all the other evidence and decide, would the jury have reached the same verdict even without that confession? If so, maybe the error is harmless. But if that confession was like the key piece of evidence, the thing that really made the case,
then it's much harder to say it didn't influence the jury's decision.
Yeah.
So basically, Chapman made things a lot riskier for prosecutors.
Yeah.
They have to be much more careful about how they get evidence.
Absolutely. They can't just, you know, throw everything they have at the wall and see what sticks, hoping a judge will overlook a minor violation here or there.
It really raises the stakes, doesn't it?
It does. But Chapman's influence goes beyond just evidence issues. It's been applied to all sorts of things, like even jury instructions.
Okay, now that's interesting. Break that down for me. How could jury instructions lead to a Chapman issue?
Well, think about it. The judge gives the jury instructions, right? Explains the law to them. But what if those instructions are confusing or just plain wrong?
Yeah, I can see how that would be a problem. The jury might convict someone based on a misunderstanding of the law.
Exactly. So Chapman comes into play because if a court finds that the jury instructions were flawed, they have to decide whether that error was harmless or whether it might have actually influenced the verdict.
So even if the prosecution had a ton of evidence, a messed up jury instruction could still potentially get the conviction overturned.
It could. Chapman makes it clear that even those I guess you could call them technical errors. They can't just be ignored. They have to be taken seriously, especially when constitutional rights are involved.
This is really making me rethink all those courtroom dramas where the lawyers are always pulling these crazy last-minute tricks with evidence and stuff.
Yeah, real life is a bit different.
Mm.
But, you know, all this impact hasn't come without some pushback.
Oh, interesting. So not everyone's happy with Chapman. Tell me more.
Well, some people, you know, some legal experts, even some judges and lawyers, they argue that this whole harmless beyond a reasonable doubt standard is just way too strict.
What's their reasoning?
They say it's led to too many convictions getting overturned, even in cases where they're sure the person is guilty. Like, they think we're letting guilty people go free because of these minor technicalities that probably didn't actually affect the outcome of the trial.
Yeah, I can see how that would be frustrating, especially from a law enforcement perspective.
Right. But the people who support Chapman say, look, the standard is essential. It protects due process. It makes sure the system is fair. And they say if we start ignoring these errors, even the small ones, it's a slippery slope.
So it's that classic argument. Do you prioritize efficiency, getting convictions, or do you prioritize individual rights, even if it means some guilty people might walk free?
It's the heart of the debate.
It's a tough one. No easy answers. But regardless of where you stand on that debate, there's no question that Chapman v. California has had a huge impact on the legal system.
Absolutely. It's a landmark case that's still being cited and debated today. And its impact goes way beyond the courtroom. It's influenced public conversations about criminal justice reform, about how we balance security and freedom.
About what it really means to have a fair trial in a democratic society. It's kind of amazing, isn't it, how this one case from 1967 is still so relevant today.
It really is. But the story of Chapman doesn't end there. Remember when we were talking about the difference between trial errors and structural errors?
Yeah, you mentioned a case that built on Chapman, Arizona v. Fulminante, the one that said some errors are so serious, so fundamental, they can't be considered harmless.
Exactly. Fulminante took the ideas from Chapman and, you know, kind of refined them, creating an even stronger framework for protecting those core constitutional rights.
So we have Chapman laying the groundwork and then Fulminante taking it a step further. It's like a 1-2 punch for ensuring fairness in the legal system.
I like that. And together, these cases show how the law is always evolving, always adapting to new situations, trying to find that right balance.
Yeah, the fight for justice is definitely an ongoing process.
Yeah.
But I think it's time to get even more specific. Let's actually look at some real-world examples of how this harmless error analysis has been applied in different contexts.
Sounds good to me. Let's see Chapman in action.
Okay, so we've talked a lot about the legal nitty-gritty of Chapman v. California, but let's step back for a second.
Okay.
Why should anyone who's not a lawyer, who's never even been in a courtroom, care about this case?
Yeah, that's a great question. Most people aren't legal experts, right?
Right.
But Chapman really shows us that the Constitution isn't just, you know, some old document gathering dust. It actually affects our everyday lives, especially when we're dealing with the government.
So it's about making sure that the system works fairly for everyone, not just legal professionals.
Exactly. Chapman tells us that even if someone's clearly guilty, the government can't just ignore their rights to get a conviction.
So it's not just about did they do it, it's about did we prove it the right way.
Exactly. It's about fairness, not just winning. And that's something we should all care about, because these principles of due process and fair trials, they protect all of us.
You know, it makes me think of that saying, it's better that 10 guilty people go free than one innocent person be wrongly convicted.
Yeah, that's a classic. And it really gets at the heart of Chapman. It reminds us that in our system, everyone is innocent until proven guilty. The prosecution has to prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt, and they can't cut corners or violate people's rights to do that.
But like we've been talking about, there's this constant tension, right? Balancing individual rights with the need for the system to actually work efficiently. Do you think Chapman got that balance right?
Well, that's a question that people are still arguing about today. Legal experts, policymakers, they're all trying to find that sweet spot. But I think Chapman gives us a good starting point. It tells us we can't just brush aside constitutional errors, even if we think the end result was justified.
So basically, we should be wary of those arguments that say efficiency is more important than individual rights. Like, sometimes you hear people saying we should streamline the legal process. Even that means bending the rules a little.
Yeah, you have to be careful with that. Chapman shows us that even those seemingly small compromises can have big consequences. They erode trust in the system, and they set a dangerous precedent. Like, if we let them get away with this small thing, what's next?
It's a slippery slope.
Exactly. So if there's one big takeaway I'd want listeners to get from this deep dive into Chapman, it's that constitutional rights aren't just abstract ideas. They have a real impact on all of us. They affect how we interact with the government, how we're treated by law enforcement, how we're protected within the legal system.
So we all have a role to play in making sure the system is fair and just.
Absolutely. And Chapman reminds us that we have to hold the government accountable, demand fairness, demand due process, and never take our constitutional rights for granted.
Well said. This has been a fascinating look at Chapman v. California and its legacy.
Definitely a case with a lot of twists and turns.
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.
My pleasure. Always a good time talking about the law.
And to everyone listening, keep those legal brains engaged, and we'll catch you next time for another deep dive into the ideas that shape our world.